Hello and welcome to KPCA LP. The show is called Food is Energy, and I'm your host, Ray Cooper. So we're happy to have you here. This is our second show, and we're really excited about this show called Food is Energy. My guest today is a very special dude, and our topics will include the environment, trees, and naked humans. Before we get into that, I want to welcome you to our new show and to thank you for listening, especially Uncle Don and my good friend Russell Giddings, two prominent members of the Petaluma community. So thank you guys, and whoever else is listening, I really appreciate the support. As the title suggests, this show is about food, but energy is also a big component. If you consider the popularity of stimulants, energy has a high value. Everybody seems to want more energy. I use no stimulants, and I've got plenty of energy. I'm not known for willpower or high energy, but I have a good, consistent amount of energy available to me throughout the day. I work till 8 or 9 every day because I work for myself, so every day is a work day, I always say, and it's getting to the point where if I come in before 9 o'clock, my wife's like, you're home early. What's going on? So, just because if I don't do it today, I got to do it tomorrow. That's the way it is when you work for yourself. I think our guest understands that. So this show is about how to tap into the energy of food and how our food choices manifest themselves in a kind of positive energy that is felt by others. So before we get into our guest, I would like to let you know that I'm working on some shows, and I have to work hard on these because I do them all myself. But next week, on the 29th of October, we're going to have a debate about Proposition 12. Now, Proposition 12 is where you voters get a chance to vote on animals, the condition of animals that are used in farming. So it's chickens, it's pigs, it's cows, and those animals, and some of those animals, those are the last animals to get really considered, I guess, because there's so much business involved with that and everybody's eating them. And so, but most people do want them to be treated better, and they're not really educated. So that's what I'm doing. I'm helping to educate them and let them know that we could do better. And so I do, obviously my position is known, but we're going to have a for and against this Proposition 12, which basically allows more room and, you know, generally more comfortable conditions for the chickens and the pigs and those animals. So then on November 5th, we're having a cacao sourcing show. Okay, now what that means is chocolate, you know, cacao. It comes from the tropical areas of the world, South America and Africa predominantly. But there's a lot of, well, unethical things going on around the chocolate, like child slave labor and people that don't get health care and those type of things. So we're working on that. And so that's November 5th. And then on November 12th, we're going to have Eric Mills. Now, Eric Mills, I've known this guy for a while. He's really a cool dude. One of the things about him is he's a one-man show. His organization is called Action for Animals. So he's a big animal advocate. He's a full-time guy. He's been doing it 30 years. I think he's in his 70s. And he's known and worked with just about everyone, and he's out of the East Bay. And I really like Eric because he's, like I said, he's a one-man show. And it's just him, and he's backed up against the wall, and he's taking all comers. And I love Eric. And, you know, it's funny because Eric is actually against Proposition 12. So I tried to get Eric on for this thing coming up on the 29th, but he's not available. So we're going to have to talk to him after the election and see where he's at on this. So speaking of energy, our guest today is also very energetic. And he's an environmentalist. I got to wake him up here. He's going to actually have to tone it down a little bit for you because he's so energetic. Might be more than you could follow. But I got some questions to ask this guy for sure. So and he's a photographer who's created his own art form. I mean, this is going to be your art form. Nobody's going to take this away from you. Whether you get recognized for it or not, we'll have to see. His focus is on trees, and his name is Jack Gescheidt. Jack, welcome to Food is Energy.
Thank you, Ray. Pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. So let's get started. Native New Yorker. Well, we got to talk about that. We have to get that out of the way.
Yes, I am. You got a problem with that, buddy, as the joke goes.
Yes, exactly.
I'm practicing my California breathing so that I can slow down and be heard.
I know.
Otherwise, I'll come at you with a speed and you'll be scared and leave the studio.
All right, so you're like a type A guy, right? You get a lot done in a day?
I've been told, yes. If I hang around type Bs, then I'm definitely considered a type A. If I hang around other type As, then we're not talking, we're just competing.
Yeah, so you're more energetic than a type B. You're not, and you're in California, you got to be laid back, so that's hard.
Well, here are the psychological underpinnings of that, as I understand them. I'm a younger brother. So I come out and there's this two-year-old monster towering over my babydom, and I'm like, hey, pay attention to me, mom and dad. Hey, over here. Hey, hey, hey. And it's been that way ever since, and I'm in my 50s now. That stuff is formative.
You have an older sister or brother?
Older brother.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Currently identified as a man, as we were joking. Yes.
Currently identified, yeah. Right.
So far, the entire time.
He may change tomorrow. You have to use the right pronoun there, Jack.
The more I live, the less I know.
So, native New Yorker, do you miss it? That's my question.
We have chatted before about this, and I have one quick and immediate, accurate answer. What do I miss most about New York? And that is really simple, and here it is, the people.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the food.
I miss the people. Well, I can go into bagels or pizza or cheesecake or, you know, the obvious stuff, and there's truth in those things. But for me, it's the people, the energy of the people that I was, you know, first pickled in. And I don't miss New York, the physical plant, what I call the engine room, but I miss its population for sure. And, of course, you know, I'm over in the Bay Area and a lot of New Yorkers are here. So
you don't feel drawn to go back to New York then?
I feel drawn to go back and visit it. And I'd love to go back, you know, for tree spirit things, which is to say, you know, New York boy, now man, returns home having been Californicated over here for 20 plus years now. So I certainly, a lot of me is here in many ways, and I love this land and the progressive thinking, and, you know, California's on the cutting edge of many new trends. But, you know, New York's the old engine room from, well, my roots originally in Europe, so it's more connected across the Atlantic to Europe and to that kind of, well, look, New York's considered in many ways, and certainly arrogantly so by its inhabitants, as a cultural capital, entertainment capital, political capital, social capital.
Yes.
Finance capital, just so many things coalesce there, and people come from all over the world to be part of, you know, the New York, Studs Terkel called it stew, not a melting pot, but a stew with chunks of everything, but all in one big, messy, yummy broth.
And they all pretty much get along. There's amazing diversity there.
I think so. I mean, if you consider what could happen in the way of conflict, or maybe has in the past, how many times you hear of, you know, some race wars or food fights or whatever breaking out there, considering there are millions, I don't know what the population it is of the five boroughs now. It was around 10 million when I was there. I don't know if that's changed, but that's an awful lot of people. And you don't hear every day of some horrible, you know, violent crime going on.
Yeah.
And frankly, I could say that of America in many ways, too. As much as the news focuses on the bad, the wrong, the violent, the outlier, but majority, we're fairly peaceful. We're arguing a lot as opposed to just waging wars and having fights.
Yeah.
Another way to look at it.
So you mentioned on an earlier show that your parents were both photographers. What did they photograph?
So, yes, both of my parents, mother and father, and mother, you know, more unusually show in that era. They're both born in the 1920s. They were both professional photographers all their lives. My father, kind of from an arts family background. My mother, definitely the black sheep of her family, the crazy woman who in her 20s left her mama, as she would call her, in Brooklyn, and went to New York to become a printer in a darkroom for a top printing lab at the time. And then, of course, was into photography and then struck out on her own and was a freelance photographer, as was my father, which is what you kind of did in the day. I guess you could shoot for a newspaper, too. But they were freelancers. A lot of them were street photographers. My mother, to answer your question, was more a people person and a people photographer, so portraits. And that could mean shooting events where she, you know, she photographed Marilyn Monroe for, I think, Pix at the time, or maybe Look magazine, riding an elephant in the circus. You know, black and white photo of Marilyn Monroe, you know, and Emmett Kelly the clown. And yeah, well, both my parents are deceased now. They died in their 80s. So I have, with my brother, the older brother, their archives. So a ton of work of both of them. And then my father, Alfred Gescheidt, and Ray Russell was her working name. He was, what he's known for is humorous photomontage.
Wow.
So what does that mean, humorous photomontage?
I kind of get what that means.
Well, for an example, to make it easy for the audience who may not, before personal computers, if you can imagine such a time, before computers at all, before Photoshop, of course, he'd have an idea. I want to take, the way an illustrator might at the time, take the head of Ronald Reagan in the 80s and put it on the body of Rambo.
Yeah.
Creating the image that is, if you Google that, you'll find Rambo.
Yeah.
Which was a poster and a postcard and was successful in its day.
Wow.
So he did a lot of that work. That worked very well in advertising, so he had a name for himself there.
Would he only do it for other people, or would he create his own work and then try to sell it?
He absolutely did both, and he absolutely, I mean, I've done a lot of what they call it here emotional growth work in California, and you sort of, one of the exercises, which I mentioned to friends. And
you have to out here.
Right, otherwise you don't get to stay.
In California, you got to leave.
Exactly. So it's sort of, you know, what were the gifts from your parents? They also go into, you know, what were the things you hated about your friggin' mother and your father that they did, and God damn it, they shouldn't have done that. But the gifts from my parents, and my father certainly had passion for his work. So he would shoot and spend tons of time making photographs and working in the darkroom, which he especially did, and he was a, as they call him, a master of photomontage for no pay. He just needed to make these images. He had this idea, and the beauty of being a photographer, true to this day and true for me as well, perhaps true of filmmakers, but easier for photography, you can be a one-man band. You can have an idea and create it and execute it, and nowadays, of course, put it on the web, independent of what anybody wants, thinks, or says. You can just do it, which is immensely satisfying. As a choreographer, you know, you can write a dance, but then you got to get somebody to perform it. You got to be collaborative with other people, which, of course, has its own rewards. But my father definitely very much inspired me. I have one memory. I was, I don't know, 6 or 7 years old, a little kid. He woke me up in the middle of the night, like 10 o'clock, 10:30 p.m. at night in New York City at our apartment building, a pre-war building at 31st Street and Lexington Avenue. And he said, here, Jack, I want to show you this stuff. And he had, I don't know, like 15 new photographs he just created. Just came out of the darkroom, mounted them on board with the dry mount press, 11 by 14s. And there are these, one, I remember that day from over 50 years ago. Right, my dad, when it woke me up, not my older brother, hey, me, pay attention to me. And it was, you know, one was the image of a beagle, the head of a beagle grafted onto beautifully the body of a duck.
Hmm.
So just think, as a little kid, you know, your dad makes that image like a child would make. I mean, hilarious, but of course, you know, the technical skills of an adult. It was wonderful. You know, another, you know, he just took two eyeballs and stuck it into a string Gouda cheese hanging off a string. So there's this face hanging off, but it's cheese, but it's weird, and what the hell? And it was creepy and horrible and wonderful.
The original cut and paste, right?
Yeah. But then, you know, again, done photographically. So in those days, the few people that were doing that, my father was one of them, got a lot of attention for it because it was now this new tool called photography, not yet really accepted as an art form either the way it is today.
Well, it's great that they were able to make a go of it, the both of them. You said earlier that your dad wasn't the outdoor type, but your mom was.
Correct.
Did she instill in you a love of trees?
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't like she said, you're going to love trees, kid, here, you know, and push my face into the dirt. But there's my father's humor. But my mother, absolutely. She was the first person I knew who talked to trees. Yeah. And it was, oh, mom, you know, whatever. But she'd be out there in the garden, you know, talking. And, of course, she was, well, like her son now, a talker.
Would she be older than the hippie generation? She probably was.
Oh, God, yeah.
She was in her 40s before the 60s.
She was in her 40s.
She could still be a hippie, though. That's pretty young, actually.
Well, there were hippies before they were called hippies. The hippies was part of a big movement during a certain era. We labeled them that. But people who connected with the earth. And, you know, if you go far enough back, I guess they're called druids or pagans or something weird,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were beatniks in the 50s.
So she was born 1925. My father born 1926. And in 1969... when I was 9 years old, my older brother was 11. We were in New York City. My father, you know, never happier than when, as I like to say, bunkered in his New York City apartment where we lived, a 3-bedroom apartment, said, you know, Al, we're getting these kids out of here. The the second school strike had hit in our grade school down the street. There was tensions. There was rising violence in 1969, a very tumultuous time. I remind people when they're upset with what's going on in today's politics, like, you know, America has survived this before. It was called 1966, 7, 8, 9, 70, 71, 72. Tough times here in the country. A lot of division over a war, right? Mm-hmm. So we can get through this too. But she said, enough, and we're getting out to the country. So we had country houses on weekends and summers, but she moved us out, or she pushed my father, and they moved us out to Westchester County, New York, upstate, just like 35, 40 miles, but night and day, night and day.
Yeah. So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to KPCA-LP. The show is called Food is Energy. I'm your host, Ray Cooper, and I have Jack Gesheit in the studio today. So, Jack, let's start with tree advocacy. I want to support you with this. Seriously, man. I mean, it didn't take much to get me to pick up on it because I was already had so many of the basics, and it was already actually reinforcing something I was already doing. So it's not uncommon for someone who becomes plant-based to see they may have done it for one reason or another, but then they all of a sudden they get all these affirmations like, hey, you're not going to get chronic illness, or you're going to, you're helping the planet, or you're helping animals, obviously, and this thing about trees. I mean, trees are a big deal. So how are we going to get people to focus on these wonderful aspects of trees, Jack?
You know, it's the big question, you know, and, you know, other people listening, if they're not into trees already, and many people are, of course, is, well, why do I need to focus on trees? You know, we've got climate change and we've got conflicts in society and other things to focus on. Why that? So I first, you know, as I go through this kind of a four-step process, it's what do trees do? What are trees? Why do they matter so much to you, Jack, or other people? And as you found out, too, also, once you kind of have a new idea, and whether it's to pay attention to what you eat or to an art form or to whatever the idea is or the belief is, once you start paying attention to it and look around, then you'll find more of that there and usually a community of people to support you in that new idea and belief and possibly to strengthen if it indeed is something that's near and dear to you where you're going to go. So for me with trees, well, back to New York and my parents being from Brooklyn, but then moving up to Westchester County. And we also went to Putnam and Dutchess counties before we had that house in Westchester. And I contrast bathed from my parents driving us back and forth. So I'd be at 31st Street and Lexington Avenue Friday night. I can hear myself speeding up. Now talk about New York.
Yeah, there you go.
Here we go. Getting wound up. And then we'd drive out to the country. And, oh, you know, the fresh air and more leaves and more space and more quiet. And, you know, you leave the city behind. And just always, to answer your question now, more peaceful, happier, calmer, and yet paradoxically, poetically, more alive, more feeling more alive whenever I'm in the woods. You know, you and I just parked in front of the radio station here. We parked under a tree and like, oh, what a pretty tree. And like, yeah, it's that simple. They're all around us everywhere.
Yeah. I think once you tap into them, you really get a lot more out of it. And then the key would be is when they're gone. You really notice them gone. You may take them for granted. Like we saw that giant magnolia. I mean, how far did we have to go before we saw a huge tree that makes a massive impact on this old Victorian? Right. I mean, it's bigger than the Victorian, this magnolia tree, and it's probably been there since the house was built.
You're referring to the one we just parked under a tree, and then we walked to a station and said, oh, look at that big, beautiful tree, really giving a huge flavor and shelter to a house. If that tree was gone, it would be right in the bare sun, and it wouldn't have the same feel about it.
Yeah, and I think people would be sad if it was gone.
I would be. Yeah. I can project that sadness onto others. Probably the homeowners like it because it's a big tree sitting in front, and they've left it there, obviously, for probably over 100 years, that old magnolia there.
Yeah. I mean, they're irreplaceable in our lifetime, something like that. I mean,
So just for context, so with what I've created, which we'll talk about, my Tree Spirit project, its mission, the lofty mission, which is a lofty mission, is to raise awareness about the critical role trees and forests play in our lives, both globally and then also personally. Mm-hmm. So right now we're talking about the personal, which is fine and appropriate. I think ultimately it starts there. Mm-hmm. It's if I come to you and start pushing on, you need to care about trees for this reason. I mean, yeah, maybe I can reach you intellectually about something off in the rainforest that's important and theoretical, but that's much different than if I say, what about that tree in the front of your house? Oh, yeah, I really like that tree. Yeah. Or as I love to do whenever I have a chance to talk, like here, is to ask people at home listening now, is there a special tree in your life, either now or often in childhood, when we had more time to play, right? We weren't so wound up or mm-hmm. so online, you know, with computers, and a tree you like to sit under, or had a picnic under, or kissed your first boy or girl under, or put a swing on, or whatever it was. I mean, increasingly, we're becoming an urbanized culture, right? About, I think, half, I forget whether it's U.S. or Earth population, live in cities, and it's projected to go to 60% by 2050. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good thing in many ways, because it affects how we feel. Mm-hmm. And then how we feel affects how we act. And the more connected to nature we feel, the happier we are in our daily lives.
Right. And I think people need to understand how trees affect them directly. Because if they don't, they're never going to tap into it. And so the aspect of locally, the trees that impact their lives is one part. It's an entry into it. But there is a much, much bigger picture as far as things that will affect us that have to do with sequestering of carbon and things like that.
I've heard you talk as an animal advocate, and, you know, I'm jumping the rails here back and forth, but if you tell people, you got to care about cows that you never see, often some factory somewhere you never hear, it can be done, but it's harder than saying, what about your dog? You like your dog, don't you?
Yeah.
Do you think that dog is different than a cow? And then you can, you know, make it so it's palpable, it's
right,
real for people.
Well, there's so much going on in the world, people can't tune into all that. I mean, you know, stuff is happening in Africa. I don't see that happening here, and it's not affecting me directly. So is that going to be on my list when I've got so many things going on in my life?
Right.
Not really, but do you want to contribute to it is the question. In other words, are you unwillingly contributing to something negative for someone else that you don't even know by doing this behavior, as opposed to maybe shifting just a little bit with what we do here at home? So what I think people need to understand is, we're trying to get educated here as far as what we do impacts the world. I mean, that's the nature of what's going on right now. The population that is existing on the world right now, the smallest little, you know, activity that you do compounds, because everybody's going to want to do it. Like if everybody wants to eat a certain thing, you know, and it becomes fashionable, they're just going to go out and deplete that. I mean, they did this back in the 1800s. People wanted to wear a fur hat. So they just went out and killed all the beaver until they had no more beaver. And if you look at England, England's a good example of, hey, let's just keep cutting them trees down, and then now look what you've got. It got to the point where the trees never came back.
So we have cut down collectively, we human beings have cut down over half of the Earth's original forest cover. It's one of the greatest effects human beings have had on the planet Earth.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Half of the tree cover.
Well, I remember that.
And it's one of the reasons, by the way, we have the issue we have. We've cut down. I mean, trees are also evolutionarily designed to be fantastic, efficient carbon sequesterers, storage of carbon, fixed carbon. They also help soil and many other things, too. We could do a show just on the benefits of trees, which maybe we'll touch on occasionally. But as we cut them down, not only do we release that carbon into the atmosphere, which is part of anthropogenic, human-caused climate change, mm-hmm. we also prevent those trees from storing future carbon. So we do, as my father would call it, a double whammy.
Yeah.
Cut down a tree, you release this carbon, you prevent it from doing future service.
Well, and there's so many other levels. Like, for instance, there is no ecosystem that could really even thrive without trees. You have to have trees there. And look at the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast. I mean, I'm surprised there's actually intact ecosystems of pure wilderness mostly in the west half of the country. But if you look at New England, it's just like England where there is some trees there because it's so vast. But the hardwood forests that used to exist there back in the 1600s, 1700s have largely disappeared, especially in the valleys.
I coming from California, I lead retreats as part of what I do at Tree Spirit, which is smaller groups of people to go out into nature with trees and make the Tree Spirit photographs, which we'll get to. We haven't even begun to talk about naked people yet.
Yeah, naked people.
And why and all that. We'll get to it. But anyway, I'd been through England, but I'd never been touring the countryside of England before. And I do this with an amazing shaman woman who's new in my life, Kara Gardner, who runs something called Heartland Healing Arts. And we lead a group of people this year and last year, to English countryside and also some of the sacred sites of stone, the ancient henges. But in doing so, I was struck by, oh, my God, like, I mean, this is the old country. And, of course, intellectually I knew it, but to see it, to go to a place which was, I got to use the word, I'm sorry, it's a lovely countryside and the lovely people, the English. But the countryside, to me, from coming from California and where I live in California, it felt barren. The land had been, like, stripped bare of its trees. And we went to an ancient forest of yew trees, which I'd never been to before, and it was lovely, although it was pretty well worn. Like, you know, Muir Woods is pretty well worn. A lot of people go through there. So it didn't feel, you know, like parts of the Pacific Northwest or even parts of California.
It didn't have a complete ecosystem. It was people and a few trees left for token.
Well, there were a lot of trees, but it just didn't feel, I mean, it was also during their hot and dry spell there. They're having a drought and a heat wave, as much of the country does, because in part we cut down too many trees.
Right.
But anyway, I just didn't feel like, wow, this is wilderness, the way you do if you go into, you know, parts of Colorado or the Sierras here in California. It wasn't virgin land, and I really appreciated California for how much has been preserved.
Yeah, like me, I've done a lot of wildernesses, and they're just so random. It's almost like a debris field. It's not manicured. It's not a landscaping situation. It's anything goes. There, you've got burnt trees, down trees, brush coming in, taking over. You see species taking over other species. You know, worms and eating up. You know, all these things are happening. It's so beautiful, but it's so random. And once you've seen it, you can tell the fake version of it, which would be, well, we got these yew trees and we've cut out everything else and people are stomping through there and there may be a few birds coming through, but it's not anything like it was because it's isolated now.
It's not teeming with a diverse life the way, say, a rainforest would be probably.
Right.
And I, by the way, I've never been into an actual rainforest myself. It's something, of course, I want to do and should do, and people are surprised I don't. But where it has a different effect on the human psyche to go in there, too. Edward Abbey, the environmentalist, wrote about, you know, that we need wild places. Wild meaning untouched by the hand and the mind of humankind. Unmanaged, which is my word for what you're describing, where things are manicured and cleaned up and clear the brush. And now we're doing that a lot in California because we're terrified about forest fires, which is a whole other thing. But those places, to me, feel very different, and they do not soothe my soul in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I could go on about it. I'm a pseudo-intellectual in this area, which is you look at something, and even unconsciously, your brain interprets what other human beings have done to it. I felt this way when I lived in New York. It's one of the reasons I had to leave New York City. I'd step out in the street to, like, take a walk, get a breath of fresh air before going back indoors to make phone calls or do my computer work or photo work. And I wanted my eyes to rest somewhere. And everywhere I put my eyes connected to my conditioned mind, I would be stimulated. Of course, mm-hmm. with advertising and signs and buses and just everything grabbing at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able, I mean, theoretically, you know, a meditative master can be anywhere.
Yeah.
And be at peace and take a breath. But I was stimulated quite crazy. I'd get on, at the time, inline skates and go to Central Park, which at least had a lot of trees in it compared to the streets in Manhattan, and I'd find rest. And then eventually, that was no longer enough. And I left Dodge, cut the umbilical cord, and went to California to be much closer to much older, unmanaged areas.
I think these days, with people being overstimulated, where they've got their phone and they're looking at the TV at the same time and they're typing into, you know, tweet or something at the same time, that's insane.
I'm sorry, I was in Instagram. What were you saying?
Yeah, right. ADD people. ADD times 10.
Yeah.
But the trees and the forest offer a sanctuary away from that, which we're going to need even more, because when I go into a wilderness, like, if I don't want to see a telephone pole, I don't want to see a gum wrapper, I don't want to, you know, because I'm like an animal at that point. You know, I want to see an animal, you know, I want to see something wild that doesn't have any influence by man, or maybe he's never seen a man before, you know, and that's just so beautiful to me. And I think what you were saying before, too, is where somebody that doesn't realize it would see a tree, and then later on they would tap into what other people have shown them. You know, that these virtues that they could get, and then that's their gift from forever. Like with me, I love trees, but I never really thought about them. And there's now, every time, you know, I look at any plant, I get something from that, and it's just a matter of focusing on it. That's all, you know. That's what your job would be doing, is to show them that good feeling that you feel by you know, recognizing how valuable these trees are. And the same thing with the animals, just saying, hey, look, I don't know these animals, but I'm not going to do something to, you know, make it worse. You know, I mean, I'm going to do my part, and just I'll do something else. And that makes me feel really good, and where you didn't even think about it before.
One of the things I try to do every day in my life is to spend, even if it's 30 minutes in nature.
Yeah.
And it's a challenge. And like you're saying, we're multitasking. Well, there's no critique of that, really, in that we kind of need, many of us, most of us, if we work and pay bills and do all the activities required of us in the roles we've created, the lives we've created, you do have to do many things at once, so-called multitasking. And, you know, so be it. It's the culture we live in, particularly if you're, you know, you were saying you work for yourself and you work until 9 p.m. I can, as a freelancer, relate to that. There's always something I want to do next, and I'm never going to get it all done. Okay, even as I say that, again, you can hear me speed up. And then I talk about, okay, now I just want to go take a walk, which I do. I live in West Marin County, California, so it's very wooded. I live surrounded by trees. And just take a walk to get over a ridge so I don't hear the town's cars anymore. And, I mean, it feeds me in a way it always has since childhood, but now I talk about it and think about it more because I'm a so-called adult, and I'm contemplative and, I guess, introspective and philosophical by nature. So I love and go, well, it's funny, they now call it forest bathing.
Yeah.
Right? And then there's ecotherapy, a branch of therapy, ecotherapy. And, I mean, great, fantastic.
But you've been doing that for a long time.
Well, I think everyone's been doing this for a long time. But again, if you label it and talk about it, you can grow the awareness around it. And I think these days that's really important because we're at this tipping point now where if we keep cutting down forests at the rate of about 1 acre per second globally, which, I mean, it's like 1.3 acres, but it's incomprehensible. That's number, you know, I sort of like, let's just think about that for a minute. And you can't let that penetrate. It's just too big and too, how can that be done? No, that can't be right. I challenge it, right? It's just 1 acre per second. Yeah. How can we do that? If we keep doing that, we're harming ourselves.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into that in a minute, but I think we should dive into the nude people. Okay. Let's get the nude stuff out of the way. No, but okay, so here we go.
Interesting way to put it.
See, in this bathing thing, this forest bathing, you know, nude forest bathing, but you've been doing this for a long time, and now people have put a name on it, but you have another twist, and that's people in these, you know, unclothed, posing in front of trees. So it's basically, you know, featuring nude people in with trees as a backdrop. My first question, though, is did your parents know about this and did they have an opinion about this? Because they're into photography.
So we're talking about the Tree Spirit Project, which is my, as I call it, the three A's of my art project, which is the artwork we're talking now, which is photographs of naked, vulnerable humans communing with trees.
Yeah.
And then activism and advocacy. So I guess I'm in my advocacy hat here at the moment. So why the naked, right? That's the question. How did this come about? And then my parents' response to it, which is...
Right. I'm just curious if they knew that. That's my added question.
Sure. Well, I was in my, 40s by the time I started doing these pictures, and my parents are, you know, big boys and girls in the art world. So who else can say, not just both their parents were professional photographers, both of their parents either photographed nudes or were photographing themselves nude or were in nude photographs.
And mind you,
not naturists or nudists, which is another discussion. They're just in the art world. And, you know, I mean, I grew up in New York and around a culture of artists in an artistic family where the question is more like, you'd never take a picture of yourself naked? Like, why not? Like, what's with that? Why are you avoiding that? And again, we're not hanging out. I mean, in the 60s, I guess there was the magazines of people, you know, jumping up and down playing volleyball naked. And it was this curiosity and you kind of look and it's prurient, but not really porn. And what is it? And it's this weird stuff. And since doing this artwork, which is hundreds of pictures of naked people, as I like to say, because it gets people thinking, communing with trees.
Right.
What's that about? And it's not, I mean, it does intersect with naturism and nudism, but I'm doing it to draw attention to the trees and specifically the interdependence of humans and trees. Okay. And if you just look at any one of my photographs and put whatever clothes you want on those people, or costumes or white robes, all of that's loaded with cultural baggage. Just the nude body. I mean, what's silly is this is like a big deal and we can snigger and joke about it because we're conditioned to do so in this culture as Americans. But nudes in artwork? Since cave paintings.
Right.
It's always there. So why is it our culture is so triggered by this stuff that it's like, oh, God, they're all naked. Like, or I was just in a supermarket and someone said, where's your work? I said, you can just remember it. Kind of playing into this, of course. Just Google naked people in trees.
Yeah.
And he laughed, and I said, no, I'm serious. You can actually Google that phrase, and that'll take you to the Tree Spirit Project.
You know,
because it's so unusual. It's so crazy. And it's all about people being vulnerable with the trees.
I think if you're coming from where I'm coming from, it's – I'm not saying it's shocking, but you don't have a frame of reference for it. But where you're coming from, it would just be another nude photograph with, you know, maybe the trees a little more focused on. And I think I really nailed it coming up with these questions today. Well, no, because, I mean, I didn't know exactly why you were doing it, but like one of my statements here is, you could say that you showed nude people with trees as the backdrop or trees with nude folks in the picture. Both are equally important, would you say? I mean, it's like, let me just throw this out here. I'm going to go off script on this a little bit. But like, let's say, hey, my name's Jack Ashite, and I'm, what do you do? Blah, blah, blah. I'm a photographer. How would you like to be photographed in the nude? And they're like, what? You know, but you say, no, there's more to it. And what I'm saying is, I'm just like a guy that grew up in a small town where most people don't want to be photographed in the nude. And so I'm actually giving you credit in the respect that you've created something that's the combination of it. And again, I got vulnerability written down here, which you already mentioned that word. But there seems to be another underlying message, which I think is even more valuable. And I know you must tap into this, but I've never heard you mention it. Without trees, we as humans are not only vulnerable, we are completely dependent on them for survival. And you are depicting that in a way, because here you are, the naked people are embracing these. They're not just standing in front of the trees. They're interacting. They're tree hugging. I mean, they're, you know, wrapped around the trees. And then you've got them all different. You know, there's thousands and thousands of photographs like this. But if you looked at it that way, I think that it's a great way to send that message that not just are we vulnerable by being naked in the trees, which is obviously most people see that vulnerability, but also that the trees are protecting us in this world from annihilation.
So look, I ponder this a lot on how precisely to use language, which I am often not always precise about. Well, there you go. Hear that kind of precision I'm attempting, and it's futile always because language is a communication of symbols. It's not the thing. It's not the trees. I can only talk about trees conceptually. But would we survive if all the trees on Earth were destroyed? I think the species would survive. I would argue, though, that we would not thrive. We would not be at all a well species. Mm-hmm. I would say we're already currently in the state where ecotherapy has sprung up organically because we desperately need it. There's a book, Richard Louv wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, and he's the author. People may not know that name or that book, but he coined the phrase you may have heard called Nature Deficit Disorder.
Oh,
it's
no.
A disorder for everything, NDD, nature deficit disorder. And that's, you know, the studies, of course. I mean, for me, this is such common sense stuff, but we, of course, you know, worshiping the god of a certain Western model of science need to do a study, double blind, repeatable, and show that, yes, indeed, if you raise children indoors, you know, under-exercised and cut off from nature, from sky, not just trees, but, of course, trees and forests and streams and ball fields, just outdoors in the sun and the sky, if they don't get enough of that the way we used to get more of it in this culture, in America specifically, children will suffer all sorts of disorders. And for me, it's why I'm not a researcher, and we need research, and I value it. We have to have these studies to point to. I've got one on the table here about livestock and climate change and deforestation and such, but at a certain point, for me, common sense kicks in. Oh, and actually, a very famous rational scientist, I always love to use, this is one of two or three quotes I always quote when I give a talk of more than 5 minutes, said the following, and I love this quote. See if you listeners can guess who said this, okay? I'm trying to decide whether I should give his name up front or at the end. Anyway, the intuitive mind is a sacred gift. The rational mind, its faithful servant. We have created a society that has forgotten, that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift.
Yeah.
And the gift being intuitive mind. So who said that? Albert Einstein.
Hmm.
Known to be a rational thinker and a scientist, of course. But he was focusing on the loss of our trusting our own intuitive abilities to know, even without a study corroborating it, which is good to have, mm-hmm. that nature really is important to our health. And when I say nature, unmanaged nature, not a park made out of plastic where kids can play in this area this way, but where they're off leash, free to run in the woods, find their own limits, test their bodies, and commune with nature in a way that humankind has done for our entire time on the planet, about 200,000 years on Earth.
Up until the last 100 years or so.
Up until post-industrial revolution, when we're starting to make the separation from nature in a big, big way and dramatically changing the way we function.
There's a price to pay. If you just tuned in, you're listening to KPCA. The show is Food is Energy, and we've got Jack Ashite on. And we're talking about trees, and we're talking about Jack's profession, which is a nature photographer, and specifically artistic photos of naked people, I guess we'll say, with trees as the backdrop. And I've written down here, are we not completely exposed without them? naked. We'd be naked without our trees. So there's another way of looking at it.
Literally and figuratively.
But the thing you just said about intuitive mind and what was the other one? Intuitive
and rational mind.
Rational mind. Okay. That kind of reminds me of a theory that I've just sort of focused on, and it's called the objective reality and the subjective reality.
Mm-hmm.
The objective reality is the real reality, like what you cannot change. It's the absolute truth that God looked down and that's ended up the history.
You and I are sitting here at a desk with microphones in front of us, and we can agree on that.
Your shirt is brown, right?
So, well, that, I think it's a little green, but
okay. See, and that's the subjective.
I was teasing you, of course.
No, but the thing is where for some reason you might not want it to be brown, but it could be interpreted a different way. So what I'm saying is, in this world, the objective reality is what we perceive, and then we filter it through the subjective reality, which is what we want to believe. So there's a big problem there, because we're pretty good at that. Like saying, well, you know, that's kind of light blue, but we could argue for 3 days over exactly what color your T-shirt is, Jack. And we could actually go to war over that. We could never agree on that. And some of that is just interpretive. But to be successful, we need to come up with an objective reality that we all agree on. And, you know, there's people making money off of cutting down trees, they've got a different reality. I've got to feed my family. I've got to do this and I've got to do that.
Here's one I find fascinating in line with that. When I argue for, you know, ending deforestation, clearly something we should be doing, and planting more trees, or transitioning, also another source of GHGs, global greenhouse gases, away from burning fossil fuels. How is it that an oil executive, you know, and let's just all be gentle here and say, you know, some of them have children and grandchildren, they can also be loving people, probably men, I think, at the top of the oil companies. How can they advocate for not transitioning off of this fuel, which is, if you look at, you know, the science, here we go, is how objective is that? I think it's extremely objective, that product is fouling the planet that their children and grandchildren will inherit. It's not in their own interest. Even if they want to keep control and pass the money down, I get that, sure.
They're not thinking about it.
I think they, or you just...
they don't care.
It's the Upton Sinclair comment that I quoted to you before, which I practiced because I just got to memorize this simple little thing, which is, I love it. It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it.
And that's
so that's why you look to the 1%. Well, some people say it's not climate change or it's not caused by humans. Like, well, yeah, you can always find those outliers, which is what the tobacco companies did, saying, well, it's not really proven. But 97% of the science with climate change, as with, you know, cancer causes smoking, and of course our emissions in a post-industrial age these days is doing what we're doing, but and fouling the environment, of
course.
There's
always another way to justify something.
Right.
Like, for instance, why did they cut down every last tree in England? Well, some people, when they got down to a few trees, probably said, hey, you know, if we keep cutting the trees down, we'll have no trees. And then somebody said, well, if I don't cut them down, somebody else is going to cut them down. And that was it, because that's just going to negate. And there probably wasn't anybody around to educate them to, yes, when those trees are gone, they may not come back, because we didn't know back then that, hey, well, maybe they will grow back. We don't know that. So, you know, people just... they're going to create their own reality, and they're going to resist this. And that now there's a lot of money behind deceiving people. And that is hurting us all. And in my mind, too, there's another reality where once you get to $1 billion with a B, is there like an amount of billions that you're going for here, like a goal? Because, I mean, I remember on Bill Maher, he was talking to this guy that was he wasn't Bill Gates, but he was had that same company, you know, Microsoft. He was the CEO of Microsoft, this guy. And he's got a radio show or something down in L.A. He owns the basketball team down there, I think, is who he is. And he's worth $45 billion. And they were talking about Trump, and don't get started on Trump either.
I'm waiting for you to come back to naked people. You seem to be wandering, as I do.
I'm a little bit wandering, but this guy's got $45 billion And he was asking him, why didn't you, like, you could just donate, like, $1 billion, and that would be enough to not get, you know, to get a Democrat elected. And, you know, he just said, well, I'm not going to buy an election, you know. But still, at $45 billion, is there, I think there should be a point there where their reality is, you know, like, I need an extra $20 billion, or, you know, someone like you or I couldn't relate to that. But anyway, back to trees. I think, you know, here's my comment. I think, you know, and this is, you know me good, so you know I'm not messing with you on this, but, or it could be.
Well, I'll be the judge of that, yes.
what you do is certainly a great way to bring attention to trees, right, Jack?
Sure. Well, some have accused me of, well, you're doing it just to get attention, immediate attention. And I go, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, no argument. I mean, that's not the only factor, but it's one of the factors, of course.
It's not gratuitous. I've seen it. It's not gratuitous at all. In fact, Jack, you know, there's several benefits from this. But I think this is an expression of who you are. It just happens to be, it fits nicely in with your history and your path. And I think it's totally legitimate art. And I'm a guy that's coming from Petaluma that doesn't, I remember when you first told me about this, when I met you, and you weren't even vegan then, and we were at some conscious eating conference, and you said that, and I was chuckling inside. I was happy for you. I'm like, wow, this is a cool thing if you can actually get people to do this. And here's my next question. What reactions do you get from people? Do you tell people what you do? And I mean, obviously you do, but
across the spectrum, of course. Yeah. And I've also kind of learned whenever possible, instead of say what I do, show what I do. So these days I walk around with an iPad, and I can just, oh, this is, what kind of pictures do you take? They say. And as soon as I say anything, each person is going to come up with a different image. So I just show them the pictures. Mm-hmm. And that's very different than talking about something.
Right. All right, let's segue. If you just tuned in, you're listening to KPCA LP in Petaluma, and I want to say thank you for listening. Jack Scheidt is here with us. The show is called Food is Energy, and the show is about energy. Well, I mean, it should be. And so we're going to touch on that. You're a very energetic guy, like we said before. How do you get your energy? Do you drink coffee and energy? Do you consume energy drinks?
Oh, no, I would say simply two fuels, mm-hmm. Other than food, which is obvious because I think most humans I know, even in California, eat. I would say love and fear.
Love and fear fuel you. Like you get energy from that? Okay.
I'm letting that sink in. I cut you off guard, of course.
I was talking about a food item here.
I know.
I'm trying to get you back. No, but
I'm messing with you, right? So I get a morning like, what am I doing with my life? I'm 58 years old. I'm from New York. I'm a type A, as you said. Sure, I'll take that label of, if it makes you happy. So, like, I've lived long enough, and I'm very passionate about nature, always have been, and people. I'm a big believer in people. I can have trouble with labels of people, but individual people in front of me, I have great respect for and care for and want to connect with. It's how I'm wired.
So,
and then, of course, the natural world and trees specifically is how I can use my camera because I was born to photographers and I've got this gift given to me, handed down from the generations. How can I combine them and do something with my life that's of value?
Okay.
To raise awareness about the importance of trees. Let's not kill them all, folks. Let's really pay attention to them, love them, revere them, have them touch our lives and warm our hearts.
Okay.
And then we do the right thing from that place because it's in our interest. It's not like I have to sacrifice and suffer to do the right thing for the environment.
Yeah,
for
I mean, you'd basically be comparing something that's good for you, individual, like, hey, I'll show you something that's good for you, and here's something that's good for everyone. What's, you know, come on. I mean, let's look at what's good for everyone is always the best.
It used to cut across political spectrums. It used to. It's changed recently.
It should.
But it used to.
Well, if it doesn't, then they're not coming from the right place. But I want to go back to the answer to the question because I already forgot what you said. You said love and something else.
And fear.
Love and fear.
So that wanting to accomplish something, want to do something, want to have some meaning in my life is, I would say, love and passion.
Yeah.
And so that fuels me. And then there's also the fear component, which is, you know, oh, no, I'm not going to be able to do this thing I want to do, or I can't travel to this place, or
Actually, sorry to interrupt. I was talking about, because my next question was, what are your favorite high energy foods? But we can get back to that in a second.
Sure.
We've got about 10 minutes. But
before the first
hour. But we could do another hour. Well, I'm going to invite you back for sure, because you could be my co-host sometimes if you'd like. But, you know, when you said energy, and this show is about energy, and I was concentrating on food, and you threw me off totally when you said love and fear. But that is a really important thing because energy. Like, I come in here and I got good energy and it catches, and you go out and do something nice for somebody else. This is key because it's contagious and it's motivating. Just like if you ate some sugary thing and got all motivated, or maybe drank a Red Bull or something. I mean, it's a stimulus. It's a motivator that somebody, hey, look at this guy. This guy's doing something really nice for trees. And you have to get what level of giving that really is, and how much that's not going to be profitable right off the bat. You know, and you know that more than anyone. You mentioned that.
Why didn't you get into photographing naked humans and trees? Well, for the money. Yeah. I got it for the money, buddy. Big money there.
Well, if it's not gratuitous, you don't make a lot of money.
If it's not porn, you don't make a lot of money.
Exactly.
It's so not porn.
Right,
I mean,
not porn.
Well, I took a portfolio of early pictures over a decade ago to the New York gift show to try to get a calendar, and there's all these calendar makers there. I got it from both sides. I got it from, you know, interested, like, where are the penises? Why are you hiding all the penises? No penis. Like, this isn't sexual enough.
Yeah, right.
You know, or it's men and women. It's not really for the straight, or for the gay market.
Well,
it's not really for the straight market.
You have men and women separate.
You have to separate them out. Like, well, that's what you want to do. That's not my artwork.
Yeah.
And then, of course, many people wouldn't touch it because it had nudity in it. You can't show a naked breast, let alone a butt. I've been banned from Facebook 3 or 4 times for a week.
For
having a naked man's butt tiny, you know, halfway up a redwood tree or something.
Really?
That's, yeah.
I can't believe that.
Oh, come on.
I
it's a regulated commons. That was Facebook.
Facebook.
Uh-huh.
Well, YouTube would probably let you do it.
And you can get away with more on Instagram and whatever.
Photos.
I mean, just look, we still have a largely puritanical streak anyway, running right through the middle of this country.
There's a large portion of people that don't get what you're doing yet.
Yeah. That's fine.
They're toiling away in relative obscurity still.
I know why I'm doing
some
it.
Gigs. You got taken to, invited to the UK and Britain.
Kara Gardner, my co-leader for the England trip, and I created that trip. We just said we want to go to this place. And, of course, you know, just yesterday, God bless him, a wonderful activist, you know, emailed me and said, you know, you shouldn't be traveling. Not in those words, but he said, you know, that's not environmentally sound. Air travel is really polluting. And he's totally right. It's very polluting. But, you know, here we go. Each person does what he or she can do and feels is right and doesn't and makes other sacrifices. And you and I haven't even touched on the other giant cow in the room, which is what we eat.
We should hit on that before we run out of time. But here's the thing, though. People can always nitpick other people. You got to find good in what's going on. You know, like a guy who's got 10 kids, is he responsible for the population? You know, not him particularly, but you can pick on him if you want. I don't do that.
We each do what we can, and as you were complimenting Will Tuttle, as I compliment Will Tuttle, who showed up when I did a screening of Cowspiracy, when I first learned, oh, you're an environmentalist, Jack? You want to call yourself that? Well, do you know what eating meat does environmentally? It's huge impact on the world.
We're going to segue right into that, but let me ask you this, though. I didn't know this about you, because I'm going to credit Will Tuttle with this, Dr. Tuttle, that you were environmentalist and had a showing of Cowspiracy scheduled. But you weren't plant-based then?
Will Tuttle called me up out of the blue, didn't know who he was. Oh, hi, Mr. Tuttle, who are you?
Right.
And
Why were you showing Cowspiracy in the first place? Because it was an environmental film?
Because I saw the trailer for it. Get this. I saw the trailer for it, which was 2.5 minutes long, and it was just saying, you know, what are the environmental organizations overlooking?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very well-crafted trailer, you know, very dramatic and with dramatic music. And I said, I want to see this and I want to show it. And there was this company online, TUGG.com, that lets you host a screening. They still exist. They're still great for films that aren't getting mainstream runs, which is most films. Dr. Will Tuttle called up. He's the author of The World Peace Diet.
Right.
He's a 30-year vegan activist. And back to my point earlier, he's non-judgmental about it. He's optimistic. He's non-critical. He's a great role model for me, still is, about how to, you know, if I've come to my evolution about I don't want to eat so much meat or no meat, because it's a big environmental impact, and it's not ethical, and it's not particularly healthy. And I've taken 20 or 30 years to get there. How do I expect someone to come to it in 3 minutes or 4 minutes of a discourse?
But
be patient.
But this interaction with Will Tuttle, are you crediting that with what turned you around, basically, and opened your eyes to plant-based?
I would say, to give credit where it was due, it was the movie Cowspiracy, and he is one of the featured speakers in the movie. But it was seeing a collective of 20 voices or more all agreeing that consuming animals is something that's a luxury we used to be able to get away with, and we can no longer.
Right. Not if everybody wants to participate. It's just not going to happen. Let's put it this way. If you want affordable meat, let's cut to this statement that's just a fact. This is the objective, real reality that everyone wants to act like isn't happening. if you want an $8 cooked, processed, ready-to-eat chicken, plucked, transported, grown, raised, bred, and all that, for $8, you're talking about a mass-produced product. And that's all there is to it. If you want to pay $35 for it, then maybe that chicken could be running around like you want to think it's going to be running around. But so basically, with the amount of people,
there's a lot to unpack there, Ray.
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, feeding people meat is done in mass production. If you want to call it factory farms, call it factory farms. You cannot produce meat on a mass scale without compromising the animal. And what we're talking about here is trees and saving the environment. What can one person do? What's the largest impact of what somebody can do that really cares about others, the environment? I mean,
right. So drive less, drive a Prius, car share, ride a bike, shorter showers, get solar panels in your house. All that's wonderful and great, but way bigger impact in one fell swoop, is to eat a lot less, or no, ideally, eventually, but a lot less meat. It's just huge. And in fact, it was from that movie that I learned the number. I couldn't believe this. And I'll say it again, because I think still people are taking it in and disbelieving it. It's so paradigm challenging. The number one reason we human beings are cutting down the world's forests is to raise cattle for human consumption.
Number one reason.
Because when I first heard that, I'm still like, is that really true? And I had to read it again and again and again from different sources. You know, established scientific bodies
because this is true. A massive amounts of people in other countries that don't have as many prairies as we do that are making prairies.
It's a huge export.
We only got 2 minutes, so unfortunately we've come close to running out of time. I've created a meeting called Veg Curious, in which Jack is going to be a guest on October 30th. He's going to be there live, and he'll have more pictures.
More pictures than we showed here today.
Yeah. The ones we depicted on this radio show will be there live for you to see. And I want to ask you about your foundation real quick. But before I do that, I want to have a closing remark in the respect that the vision of a better world is ours to have. It is easily within our reach to prosper beyond our wildest dreams. It will, however, require education and effort. And part of that is Jack Gesheit. And Jack Gesheit, you have a treespiritproject.com. Is that the name of it?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you tell us in about a minute and a half what that is? Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. And I agree. I think it's more important than me talking treespiritproject.com. And as a website, and as a book in process, which I'm trying to finance to get published and to reach more people, I do absolutely think it's essential to tell people, rather than come and hear doom and gloom, there's an uplifting message to this. So the bad news is, oh, no, we've caused climate change and we're heating up the globe. The good news is we can do something about it.
Okay.
The good news is we can make a difference. The good news is it's not too late, folks.
Yeah.
Don't despair. Be positive. Make a positive change. You'll feel better that you have.
Yeah. Thank you, Jack. Thank you for coming on to Food is Energy. I appreciate it.
I'm glad we sped up.
Yeah.
I got life. I got crazy ways, daughter. I got million-dollar charm.